Hello, welcome back to Football Memories and Moments and our second series. That's right, we've gone where Alan Partridge couldn't, we've got a second series. And we're kicking it off this time round with Jonathan Northcroft. After spending a good hour or so talking to Jonathan, this was exactly why I wanted to set this whole thing up. This was the type of chat that we had, and it was fantastic to hear as an 11-year-old his time watching Aberdeen beat the mighty Bayern Munich at Pottodrie in 1983 on their way to winning the European Cup Winners' Cup. For those of you who don't remember the Cup Winners' Cup, I suggest you Google it because it produced some absolute classics. It was fantastic to catch up with Jonathan. He's the Sunday Times chief football writer or something along that line. And I really enjoyed this chat because it actually made me do some research, which previous listeners would know that that's not something we do here. His moment was talking about Leicester's 2016 Premier League win, something that Johnny's written about, and it was good to get his understanding and his view of how that aberration, that anomaly, is how it came to be and how he thinks it's impacted on British football. And it was great. This was a Skype interview. It might drop in and out. I think it's pretty much fine. But yeah, it's good to be back, and we thank everyone for their support in Series 1. But yeah, we've got some good guests lined up for Series 2. Starting with Johnny. So here we go.
Okay, so the first leg had finished 0-0, and this was the 1983 Cup Winners' Cup quarterfinal, Aberdeen Bayern Munich. I just can't express how important the game this was for me as a kid and for my football club, really. But just to give you the scene, so Alex Ferguson took over in 1978 and changed what was already quite a successful club, actually. We'd been decent under Billy McNeil. We'd had a good 1970s. Always been a reasonable club, winning the odd Scottish Cup and so on. But anyway, Ferguson arrived in 78, 79. By 1980, we've won the Scottish title. By 1981, we're starting to win Scottish Cups, which we dominated for the next sort of 5 or 6 years. Started to dominate the old firm, beat Celtic and Rangers on a regular basis. And come 1982-3, the team is really at its peak and starting to push new horizons in Europe. We'd actually gone in to the Cup Winners' Cup in the preliminary round, the old preliminary round, which shows you, you know, what sort of outsiders Aberdeen were at the start of the competition. Beat Sion of Switzerland 7-0 in a home leg to get through into the competition proper. We'd had a few near misses in Europe under Fergie, notably beating Ipswich in a 1981 UEFA Cup tie. Ipswich were the UEFA Cup holders, brilliant team at the time. Aberdeen took them to the cleaners. Peter Weir was incredible at Pottodrie. So there was a lot to say that Aberdeen were a really good side. But when it came to this quarter final, Bayern Munich were just a different level, different gravy. Absolutely outstanding team. People like Augenthaler, Paul Breitner, brilliant midfield player, Dieter Hönes, Karl-Heinz Rummenigge up front. You know, a really fantastic football team. Germany, of course, had done really well in the 1982 World Cup. Bayern themselves were to go on and win the league. I mean, this was a top side. And Aberdeen went away to the Olympic Stadion in Munich. Probably, arguably, the best performance, the best single performance of the Ferguson era, even including what was to come next, was that 0-0 draw in Munich, because Aberdeen went and played one of the top teams and were comfortable, looked like a practiced, experienced European side, and came away from this game with a 0-0 to take back to Pottodrie. But even then, Bayern Munich were favourites, given the level of player that they had, given their European experience. Started, we're talking March 1983, midweek. Game starts. Klaus Augenthaler, I remember looking at him as a kid. He just looked bigger than all the Aberdeen players. He looked just an athlete, you know, just something you didn't see in Scottish football. Beautiful footballer, powerful midfielder, scored, sweeper really, scored a fabulous goal to go 1-0 ahead.
Before we get into that, Johnny, we'll just, so that's the background. So let's just set the scene.
Sorry.
the game is on YouTube, so people can go and look at this, but the Pataudry lights don't seem that bright, and it seemed it was a bit of a muddy pitch. The main two things that stand out about it in an age now where we do tend to set a little bit of store by this because of the more cultural side of football. But do you think they're two of the best kits to have ever played in European football? Do you think? Because that Bayern white kit is tremendous, isn't it?
There's a strong argument for that, yeah. Yeah, that Bayern Munich white kit was... and I remember it in the mud, actually, and under the kind of dingy floodlights. It was part of how they just looked like a slightly superior, breed of human being, almost, footballer, yeah. Incredible athletes. And they looked fantastic in their white kit. But our sort of pinstriped red number was... I mean, that's iconic for any Aberdeen fan. And you can't picture... the 80s without picturing Willie Miller in that shirt, or Alex McLeish, or Mark McGee, who filled it quite, Doug Rugby. So two beautiful kits.
And where were you in the ground at the time? So if you're looking at the TV screen view of it, you're looking at, I think the main Aberdeen support was to the left of the camera.
To give you an idea of Pataudry's architecture. Funnily enough, the actual Aberdeen end swapped during my sort of childhood and youth. From the end to the side to the left of the camera is the Merkland Road stand, and the side to the right is the beach end. And it actually swapped a couple of times, which was the so-called home end. Nowadays it's the beach end because they built a huge sort of white elephant stand there. At the time, I think it probably was the Merkland Road end, and the away supporters, I can't remember many Munich supporters, but there would have been a few, would have been in the corner beside the beach end, possibly. There was a family stand on beside the beach end, and then you had the main stand, the camera's looking across at the main stand, which was very old-fashioned. Where the camera gantry is on the south stand. And this was the sort of newer stand at the time. And that's where me and my dad and my brother always used to sit. And the south stand, the whole thing with the Aberdeen support, you've got to remember the kind of local characteristics of Aberdeen being a city where there's an Aberdeen comedian called Buff Hardy who once tried to explain the Aberdeen range of emotions, which would be that if things are going brilliantly and you ask an Aberdonian, how are you? They'll go, nay bad. And if things are going just, they're having the worst day of their lives, they'll go, nay great. And that's, we're not an emotional people, is the point I'm trying to make. Nay bad and nay great is about as emotional as you get. And the South Stand was notorious for being a quiet place. Fergie himself used to joke about the rustle of sweetie papers. But... It could take off, and it certainly took off that night. So we're all underneath where the cameras are, basically, and it becomes pandemonium. And I think that does come across actually in the video, from what I can remember.
Yeah, it does. And there's one thing I want to. I mean, we'll talk about it now, so we don't have to dwell on it later. But it's not fair to say we're not putting out a spoiler here, or we're not spoiling anything. But Aberdeen win. And at the end with the pitch invasion, with all the fans on there, if you look at I think it's around the eighth minute of the video that's on YouTube, you can see the copper leading away a young lad who's decided, I'm going to arrest someone and he's going to be the one that I'm going to arrest. And you can just see him walking him off the pitch. But so you're in the stadium and the thing is this, there's going to be hopefully people listening to this who probably certainly weren't conscious of football when the cup winners, this game is proof that the Cup Winners Cup used to be such a fantastic tournament, didn't it?
It did. So I mean, the Cup Winners Cup, and you can argue this, depends on what your club's won, really. I've had this argument with fans who, their club's won a UEFA Cup, but in my mind, and I think it's true, I think it was the second competition in Europe at the time. I mean, it was an unusually good year for the Cup Winners' Cup as well. If you remember, I think the European Cup was won by 1983. I think it was Hamburg, wasn't it? It was Hamburg because we played them in the Super Cup. And Hamburg weren't actually a fabulous side. We beat them in the Super Cup final. So they weren't amazing. But if you look at the Cup Winners' Cup, Tottenham Hotspur, Bayern Munich, Paris Saint-Germain, okay, they weren't quite the PSG of now. You know, Galatasaray, Austria Vienna, Barcelona, Red Star Belgrade, who were incredible, Inter Milan, Real Madrid, Gothenburg, who were a very good side themselves. It was a brilliant competition. It was arguably as strong as the European Cup was. Certainly in the later stages, it was a really strong competition once you got to the sort of quarterfinals. And, you know, how often do you get Real Madrid and Bayern Munich in the same competition, and you have to beat them both like we did? So a very good, very, very good competition. And actually, Bayern Munich finished ahead of that Hamburg side who won the European Cup. Bayern Munich finished ahead of them in the league to win it.
Yeah. So they were clearly a great side. And it was the away goals, wasn't it? So 0-0 going into a second leg is actually one of the most dangerous results. But what was the atmosphere like when, as you've pointed out already, Augenthaler gives Bayern the lead? And it's a fantastic goal, isn't it?
It's a brilliant goal. So, I mean, in my sort of long-winded scene set I was giving you there, I was trying to explain how good Bayern Munich were and how good our result was away from home. But they were still the favourites. And Klaus Augenthaler just kind of emphasised that by scoring this fabulous goal that you just didn't really see in Scottish football at the time. And the thing about Aberdeen in Europe, you know, we'd become the best team in Scotland, but we'd had some pretty hefty reminders of how far we actually still had to go in Europe. So a big point in the club's history was being sort of demolished really by the great Liverpool side in 1980. You know, we were Scottish champions. We met Liverpool in the European Cup, just didn't lay a glove on them. They were far better. And we'd had those sort of reminders. And then this Klaus Augenthaler goal, I suppose, just brought it all back. You know, we'd turned up thinking, we've got a chance here. And it just seemed to remind you how good they were. And I remember that was in the context of a very controlled first half from Bayern. They scored early. It's a lovely goal. And then they settled in the game and dominated it for a good sort of half an hour, 40 minutes.
But then Augenthaler turns from hero for Bayern's sake and flip side. He goes from hero because he must be watching that. He must not be watching it. But what I'm saying is that he would have seen that and gone, why didn't I just clear it?
I know. I think it was part of the comfort that Bayern Munich were enjoying in the game and they just had this class about them. And maybe they were starting to underestimate Aberdeen. I know from I've actually written about this and spoken to people at the Bayern Munich end. They clearly expected to win, and maybe they were a bit complacent, and maybe Augenthaler was infected a little bit by that. But you know, I think we forced that goal, that equaliser that we're about to talk about. We just forced that. You know, when it's a bit like Wigan in the FA Cup the other night against City. Sometimes a smaller club can just, you know, if the fans are in the right mode and there's enough energy on the pitch, they can just force situations. And I think this goal was a classic example. Forced a mistake from a great player and then capitalised.
And the person in that, so the goal is, just to give a brief explanation, but because I'd rather know more about the emotions that you feel rather than the actual goal.
Yeah.
But the work is done by, I think, is it Eric Black with his back post header? He, by the way, Johnny, this is the most research I've ever done for any of these podcasts. So I do hope you feel
it. Does this game deserves the most research?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it kind of is a kindred spirit thing, though, isn't it? Because there's a lot of parallels, and I don't want to mention Everton, and I briefly do, but there's a lot of parallels between this and 2 years later when Everton do the exact same, except we only conceded one goal, not two, to Bayern at home. But Eric Black, now watching the video, Eric Black was, I couldn't get over how great he was in the air.
Eric Black, I mean, you know, you really are. You could bring me to the verge of tears here because you're talking about some of my favourite footballers, people in the planet, and Eric Black's high among them because what a player he was, and what, you know, he was young. I was 11 years old at this time. I think Eric Black was 17, maybe 18. So you obviously at that age, you sort of feel a connection with the younger players. And Eric Black had actually, bizarrely, he'd shown me and my brother round Pittodrie as a young boy in the ground staff about 2 years previously. My mum and dad we'd been in town. Pittodrie's on the beach. We'd just on a whim decided to go and have a look at the stadium. I don't know why, because we went to the games, but let's go and have a look at the stadium. And then we knocked on the door, and you know, football was informal in those days. So someone answers it. Oh, the lads want to see around the ground. Yeah, fine. And they summoned this young lad from the ground staff, and it turned out to be Eric Black. So we didn't know that at the time. He was just a kid, but we got his autograph at the end of it. My mum said, just in case he becomes a player, get his autograph. So I had a particular connection with Eric Black. For this goal, I mean, as you say, Barry, his ability to hang in the air was just extraordinary. I think Eric was about 5'9", maybe 5'10" at the most, but he scored so many headers, and he just had this graceful, beautifully timed leap, and he wins a header. And then another sort of young player and favourite player of mine, Neil Simpson, just scrambles, forces the ball in, and Neil Simpson, he was that player that you could imagine yourself being. He was that guy that, you know, he was a big, rangy kid, 18 years old, local boy. He was decent enough technically, but by no means the best. But what he had was just no fear, pure energy, maybe a bit of a Tom Davis, I don't know. And he just wanted this more than anyone, that old cliche, but it's true. And he just didn't score that many goals, but, you know, what a goal to score, and just forces it over the line. Again, in front of the beach end, muddy goal mouth, to sort of bloody Bayern's nose just before halftime.
And so what was, I mean, other than the sheer elation of the goal, but what was your emotion, the 11-year-old Jonathan Northcroft, what do you do?
Well, at that age, you kind of go from despair to, you know, ridiculous optimism, just like that at that age. And I'd gone from thinking, oh, well, you know, we've got no chance here, to, well, we're going to win this, Dad. You know, it just changed like that. But it did. It lifted the whole stadium. I think that was a moment that everyone thought, wait a minute, we're not out of this. Something can still happen here. And it also, it's just that feeling, you know, when you're playing a better team, or a team that you think's a better team, and you just manage to do something against them. Even that in itself is a kind of triumph. So there was all those feelings, but it was just like, yes, you know, we're not out of this, and we're not bowing out of this easily. And yeah, you know, at that point, I did think, yeah, this is on, because you do when you're naive and you're 11.
And that bubble was burst. Now, again, listening, watching the YouTube, is I think it would have been doubly burst had you been at home watching it on television, because the commentator, I don't know who the commentator is, certainly sort of a host, you know, the Scottish one.
Probably Archie McPherson.
Well, no, it's. I don't think it's. I recognise it's Archie McPherson's voice. Oh,
Go on. Is it an English voice?
No, it's definitely a Scottish voice. It's definitely a Scottish voice. Right. But anyway, he says when Hans Flugler scores the second goal, he says, and that's probably going to put Aberdeen out of Europe. And was that before? I mean, also just friend, it's an old favourite in Jim Leighton. Jim Leighton could do, it is a good goal, and it's great to hear that. And likewise with Augenthaler's goal, the clapping of the home fans in acknowledging, which is something very, very much a bygone era, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
but you know, Leighton could do better. How are you feeling when, because ultimately you have to score two more goals regardless.
Yeah. I mean, I go back to being 11. Having scored, or, you know, having equalised once, I think my feelings changed actually after the Simpson goal. And yes, they come out and Flugler scores another lovely goal, albeit that maybe Leighton could have done better. But anyway, it's another lovely strike from distance. And it was a reminder, certainly, again, that we're playing a better team here. But I there was something different in the air after halftime, after the Simpson goal. So I didn't feel we were out of it. I didn't feel we were out of it at all. You knew you had to score twice, but you know, I think from that whole second half was an incredible sort of whirl, really. And we were playing much better. We were playing pretty well at that point. So yeah, it was like another. You admired it, but I didn't think we were out of it at that point.
And the sensation then of the second goal, because the second goal, I mean, I'll be honest, I always knew you always knew the result, I always knew you'd won the cup this year, et cetera, et cetera. But the second goal is, I mean, that free kick routine is almost Roy Race levels of coming up with something mental.
Yeah, it's that, if you watch one part of it, just watch that free kick. So there was a history with that free kick routine. We called it the dummy free kick, right? Maybe this is the name me and my dad had for it. Aberdeen, we'd tried it before and it hadn't worked. And it was almost like, so I'll just to explain, Gordon Strachan and John McMaster stand over the ball. One's left footed John McMaster, one's right footed Gordon Strachan, edge of the box. They both, obviously, they've both got the capability to take it, and they both run up to the ball, and the whole trick is that they both dummy it for each other, and then they feign a kind of mini argument as if it's been a mistake, as if they've, you know, just botched this free kick routine. Of course, it's perfectly rehearsed, because what then happens is Strachan whips the ball in, quickly whips the ball into the box. But we tried it before and it hadn't worked. And I remember when they were going up to do this free kick, there was a kind of like, oh no, they're not going to try this thing, are they? They're not going to, oh no, don't embarrass us. And they did it. And there was that sort of momentary feeling of, oh, why have they tried this? And then of course, Strachan just whips the ball in beautifully. And big Alex McLeish, you know, magnificent, magnificent header, plants it into the net. Now, the Bayern players, as I say, I've written about this as a journalist, and they just couldn't believe this sort of routine was so corny. They just couldn't believe that a team would actually try this deliberately. Do you know what I mean? I guess they played football at a different level to others. They, you know, why would you need some sort of daft trick to try and score a goal? So they were genuinely shocked and taken aback by this. And it was being done in that way that then opened up what happened about 60 seconds later. I mean, that goal was almost worth two goals. It was almost the second and the third goal all rolled in one.
That's a really good way of putting it, because I was just thinking there, like, it's I'm a huge Terry Pratchett fan, and there's a line in the Sam Barnes books occasionally where we're saying it's a million to one shot, but it might just work, and that's what it feels like, and it feels like Bayern had the rug completely pulled from under them, and they never recovered, because as you say, 60 seconds later it's John Hewitt who scores, and you know what's it like then?
Well, I mean, it's almost one continuous memory, to be honest, because, you know, we're in the South Stand. I've given you the sort of character of that place, usually quiet. But when McLeish scores, the place goes mad and we're on our feet and, you know, we're just hugging strangers, which is so un-Aberdonian. I can't tell you how un-Aberdonian this is, but... you know, my dad's hugging the bloke next to him. I'm getting lifted by, you know, men, and it's everyone's just bouncing up and down. And the game restarts, and we're all still sort of celebrating. And, you know, suddenly the ball's near Bayern's box, and suddenly the ball's going into the box, and everybody then refocuses. And it's another brilliant Eric Black header, incredible Eric Black header. Very, very good. I mean, it's a world-class save by the goalkeeper, an absolutely world-class save. Manfred Müller, I think, is the goalkeeper. And then John Hewitt, who had another local boy, had a habit of scoring big goals, super sub, just pokes it through the goalkeeper's legs, and it's in. And you know, it was just a one continuous celebration. I think the camera, I think if you watch, you're going to direct people to YouTube footage, and I think the camera, which takes the ITV feed, I mean, they basically missed the build-up because the camera's still, the TV's still replaying the second goal, and then suddenly it's one of them that's like, they cut to Aberdeen on the attack again. But that's actually what the experience was like in the stand, that you're still kind of celebrating the second goal, and then cut to suddenly John Hewitt's putting it through Muller's legs for the third, and I've never felt like that in my life. Incredible.
There's a cracking screen grab, which I might one day go back to for you, but if you go to 7 minutes 14 on the YouTube, on the one that we will put on our WordPress site when for people to go and look at, is there's a great picture of Muller sat on his bum, the ball's in the back of the net, and I think it's Strachan and Hewitt just running away, and you can see everything, and it's a really good moment. It could have ended there, didn't it? But you know, you went on to beat Real Madrid in the final, and do you still think about the days of how it could be, because obviously Aberdeen haven't replicated that as an adult.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that it took 20 years to move on. I don't know. I mean, yeah. So we go on and beat Real Madrid. I mean, funnily enough, I was back in Gothenburg last year. It was my dad's 75th birthday. Me and my brother took him to the stadium because we didn't get to go to the final. So for us, it was this 1983 quarterfinal was the game because we didn't go to the final. My dad had this daft idea that we had to be in school and learn stuff. But anyway, so this was the high point. This Bayern Munich game, I think, is my high point as an Aberdeen supporter. What came after, we won a couple more league titles under Ferguson. We won the Super Cup. We won more Scottish Cup, League Cups. We won everything else again. And then, you know, the rest of the 80s of Aberdeen were quite decent. There or thereabouts, won more cups. But it was a point in time because in the mid-80s, Fergie leaves, 1986, he leaves. And it coincides with Graham Souness arriving at Rangers, and Rangers starting, English clubs are banned from Europe. Rangers have suddenly got a lot of money, and they're able to buy some of the best English talent, guys like Chris Woods and Mark Haley and so on. And they dominate. And then, you know, football's changed. Money's now important. And really, since then, it's been Celtic and Rangers swapping it. And Aberdeen, you know, we've won a couple of cups, League Cup. But we'll never win in Scotland again, probably. Never win the Scottish title again. Well, we might in, you know, 20 years' time, whatever. But let alone dominating Europe. You know, I mean, Aberdeen have, for the last 4 years, have got into the Europa League preliminaries and, you know, won a couple of games but not been able to get into the Europa League itself. So the height of our ambition now is to try and get, if we could get a Europa League group stage, wouldn't that be amazing? Yeah. Whereas 1983, the height of our ambition is beating Bayern Munich and Real Madrid to win European trophy. So that's how it's changed. It did take a long time to readjust. But as a middle-aged bloke, I think I'm kind of now at peace with the fact that I had this incredible stroke of fortune to be a kid when we were at our absolute peak, and I wouldn't have had any other way. And it doesn't matter if we never win another thing, because I've been really lucky to have had that. I feel very sorry. Younger Aberdeen supporters get bored by their older brothers or their dads or whatever about the glory days, and I really feel for them because they didn't get what we got. But there you are. Yeah, well, look, my moment would be Jamie Vardy's goal against Manchester United in, I think it's November 2015, and it's part of the Leicester 2015-2016 title miracle, or whatever you want to call it.
And so ultimately, you're talking about, because obviously they've gone from, they went from just about staying up the season before, going through that whole summer of turmoil, and then appointing Ranieri. is that story, and it's a story that you've spoken to the protagonists, you've spoken to the people involved, you've spoken to the fans.
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, we've just been talking about a time when probably football, society wasn't great, but the football was pure. Now we're talking, about a time where society is better around football.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The football ownership isn't so pure. But is it possible to strip that Leicester story out of that and enjoy it for what it is?
Yes, it is. And that's the reason I've chosen it as a moment. I mean, there's a lot of personal reasons that it's special to me. I moved to Leicester in the middle of that title winning season from Liverpool. I've written a book about the title, but that's not actually why I chose it. Because the reason I chose it is because I think maybe because I was been thinking about the Aberdeen again, because we're doing this podcast, and there's a connection there, because I think Leicester winning the title is the only time maybe as an adult that I've had that magic, that feeling, that purity, I suppose, of anything being possible in football. Since I was that kid watching Aberdeen, I think that's why the Leicester title story is so special, because it comes amid the context of football, certainly in the top flight in England, but really around Europe, being a sport that's competed for by sovereign wealth funds, Russian oligarchs, you know, Chinese billionaires, American hedge fund owners and investors, and this, I won't bore you with all the economists who produce tables showing that it's all about wage bills equals success and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, we know all that, and it's been like that for the last 20, 25 years. And Leicester are in the middle of that. And Leicester winning the title is like Aberdeen winning that cup. It was just a sudden aberration where we went back to football being about something else, and that's why thinking about it even now, just it's the first time I've had that excitement, that really pure excitement since being a kid.
It's incredible that in the end, yes, it got a bit squeaky bum, but I'd say for a period of maybe, I think it's February to about early April, Leicester are pretty untouchable, apart from the Arsenal defeat where
that's
where
right. They, yep.
But, and that's where, you know, the story never went away, was it? I don't even remember the bubble of they're gonna cock it up.
No,
there was no hope of that happening, was there?
There wasn't. I mean, and in hindsight, it looks like what it was, which was a bit of a procession. But of course, because it was Leicester, they weren't normal league leaders. You did feel that up to a point, you did feel that of course they could collapse here because they're in uncharted territory. They've never done this before, and there was no precedent for it happening. So even when they were 5, 6, 7 points clear, there was still a feeling that they might have ruined it. But I mean, for me, the moment I really thought they were going to win the title was when they beat Man City at the Etihad, and I think they went about 8 points clear, maybe whatever. And then they actually lost to Arsenal the following week, but they lost really well. They played brilliantly and didn't deserve to lose. And Arsenal kind of over-celebrated, really, getting this win against Leicester. They clearly thought they were going to then go on and win the league. But I that's not how it felt watching it, I must admit. I think I knew Leicester, the team, the players, the club, better by then, and thought I'd still have them as favourites. And almost the Arsenal kind of reaction showed why they were a flawed outfit, because they just lacked they were the best team in the league probably, but they lacked the mental strength. Spurs were good, but not what they are now. You know, they were still sort of young, still growing. Obviously, Chelsea were imploding under Mourinho, United were horrendous under Van Gaal. Klopp had just arrived at Liverpool, and you know he was still adjusting. They had a good spell, but of course, one of the reasons Leicester won the league was because the big clubs weren't quite good enough that year. But they were just also the way, as you sort of mentioned, by the way they handled it, the mental strength in that Leicester group was extraordinary. And really, from when they beat Spurs, I think 1-0 in mid-January, one of those midweek games, nobody even noticed. I think they went back to off the league at that point, and they stayed there. They stayed there, and really there were little wobbles, but there was there was nothing like the fall away that people thought might happen.
The internet would always say, you know, the main running joke on Twitter was when the world baby Jamie or baby Riyad is 16, 2032. Tell me, Dad, how was it named? Well, son, Nigel Pearson's son, children, or players, Leicester players went to Thailand. How much did as much as Nigel Pearson did well, could Nigel Pearson have delivered that title win?
He couldn't. But you know, it's that old sort of thing about success has many fathers, doesn't it? I mean, Ranieri couldn't have won the league without Nigel Pearson's groundwork. And one thing that interests me is how, I think it happens a lot in football, how sometimes it takes two managers to build a great team, to build a high point. Sometimes it's one guy doing the groundwork and then it's another bloke arriving, keeping the structure in place, but maybe adding his own little thing. And then you get a sweet spot for 6 months to a year. And then after that point, the old guy's work sort of almost finishes and the successor is alone. Think about Martinez and Moyes. I've given you an Everton example for obvious reasons, Barry. But, you know, Everton were probably at their best when Martinez took the Moyes Everton and just added his own thing to it, but hadn't ruined what was there before. And I think there's a similarity with Ranieri and Pearson. Pearson built the club in two spells, starting in 2008 to, I think it was 2010 or whatever. Then he comes back in 2011, takes him up from the Championship, having already done it from League One in his previous reign. Takes him up from the Championship after a couple of near misses. So it's a club that he's had to keep. Keep sort of finessing, keep sort of refreshing the group, but they've actually become quite battle-hardened through their experiences. You mentioned the Great Escape. You know, that Leicester actually showed title-winning form in the last nine games of that season to stay up from a totally hopeless position. They won 7 out of 9. So there's a lot of background there. They built themselves up as a group. They were a group that were used to handling pressure. Pearson laid a huge amount of groundwork at the club in terms of recruitment. Steve Walsh was his assistant manager, not just his head of recruitment. So there was a kind of route between the recruiting side and the first team, which meant that, you know, the guy that was bringing the players in also had a say in whether they were getting the pitch or not. And I think a lot of clubs could learn from that. Pearson was very collegiate in how he managed, so he gave a lot of power to the fitness guys in terms of how they could design the week in terms of recovery and fitness and so on, you know. And if you remember, Leicester's incredible fitness record was a big part of the season because they almost had no injuries, didn't have to change their first 11. So there's a lot of stuff that was in place, but Nigel Pearson would not have won the title because he hadn't operated anything like that level in his career. Whereas Claudio Ranieri, a man who had operated at some of the biggest clubs in Europe in his 60s, 39, 30, whatever years as a manager behind him, he hadn't won anything, but he'd come really close to winning things with big clubs. And it turned out that he did know, after all, how to win.
And that's an interesting one, isn't it, about Ranieri, is that do you think it helped the players? Because because of his time at Chelsea, where, again, he came very close. He's really, really, I mean, he may have struggled in the final against Porto, but Chelsea should have beat Monaco in the semi-finals of the Champions League in 2003. But because he used to write things like toot-toot in his programme notes when he was Chelsea manager, did the fact that he was treated as a comedy figure take the pressure off the players because Ranieri could say what he wants and everyone have a laugh in the pressers?
100%. He was very clever. He knew he by the end of his time at Chelsea, he'd worked out the British press. He'd been the object of ridicule, the Tinker Man, and all that kind of stuff. And then, if you remember, it was Abramovich. So Abramovich arrived in Ranieri's last season. So that Monaco Champions League semi-final you're talking about, was it maybe quarter-final, semi-final, was at the end of Abramovich's first season. But he decided he was going to bring Mourinho in with, I don't know, a month to go or whatever. And Ranieri became dead man walking. You might remember the headlines. He became dead man walking. But what happened to him? He'd gone from being this comedy figure to then getting a bit of sympathy from the British press. And I think he just worked out how to play us. I think he worked out what you need to do. And that there was an affection for him as this sort of lovable, well, loser, for want of a better word. He became a lovable loser. So when he was then at Leicester, he knew that this was the shtick that people were looking for. And he played it to perfection. It took the pressure off everybody because the narrative became about him, this guy that's never won, but isn't he funny? Don't we like him? He's sweet. Look how he talks. He can't even, you know, his English is a bit funny. I mean, Ranieri is an intelligent man who I'm convinced speaks far better English than he lets on in public, but like to come out with those sort of little sort of silly half Italian, half English kind of ways of speaking. And he took the pressure off the players by just making himself the narrative in a way that Nigel Pearson wouldn't have had the knowledge of how to do. And I think Ranieri obviously learnt from the mistakes of his near misses at different times in his career. One of the things that he was obviously criticised for at Chelsea was being the Tinker Man for making too many changes. And one of the things he does at Leicester is he works out the art of leaving things well alone when they're working. So he left a lot of Nigel Pearson's groundwork in place, his systems. You know, Ranieri wanted to change tactics, wanted to change training, but he was sensible enough to listen to the players and realise he should keep it in place. And then he just barely changed his team. The Tinker Man became the guy that put out the same 11 every week.
So it sounds like, you know, it's ingredients, isn't it? But we still, you know, we're not discounting the fact that certain, maybe at least 12 moons aligned in the heavens that just gave them that little extra buzz. But, you know, they've got the ingredients. They've had turmoil, so they want stability. They bring in a manager who's learned from his mistakes. They've got, you know, other clubs didn't perform to their standards, which possibly would have made them run earlier. Spurs, you know, I'm hoping for Spurs fans' sakes, didn't show the start of what could be a long-term culture of maybe being a bit sort of South Africa in cricket, if for those of you who know what that mean. But then they've got the recruitment, and you know the final ingredient in the pot is that they've got probably the best defensive midfielder in European football at the moment, now at Chelsea, obviously, and they've got out and out pace up front. And how important was that to that title winning season?
Well, this is it, and I think I'm glad you've kind of framed it in that way, because, and this is something I really kind of alighted on and tried to bring out in the book, that there are all these stars aligning. There is this perfect storm, quote unquote, that helped Leicester win the title. But to go to the old football cliche, it's about the players. And Leicester had Kante, as you say, the best defensive midfielder in Europe, a phenomenal player, a player that we'd not really seen before, in terms of combining, you know, Makalele-like defensive midfield play with outrageous energy and you know, support and counter attacks, just a different type of footballer. and proved it the next season by winning the powering Chelsea to the title. Then you've got Mahrez, who is an absolute artist of a player, who when he's hot, he is Barcelona standard. You know, when he's playing well, and he played at his best that season, 20 odd goals, assists, all that kind of stuff, world class. And then that the pace that Vardy's got, and that when you can play that pace within the system, the way of playing that Leicester played, i.e. low block, counter-attacking, fantastic distribution from the likes of Schmeichel. Schmeichel's one of the longest kickers in the game, actually a very good long distributor as a goalkeeper. And when you had, you know, Kante winning the ball early and to start counter-attacks, when you've got extreme pace like Vardy's, then it becomes a world-class weapon. And Vardy's, he's shown himself since to be a proper international-class footballer. But as I say, his attributes were world-class that season because of the way they were being used within that system. And the moment of the season I want to talk about is, after all, him breaking the record for scoring in consecutive games in the English top flight, which is extraordinary. And that shows you the level that he was performing at that point.
I went and had a quick look at the goal because I needed to remember and remind myself of the one that it was. But I remember watching that game. I think that's the first moment that I think Leicester are going to be there or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And that's where they kick on, really, isn't it? And that whole thing is that's kind of the story within the story, is it, when it comes to pressure? Do you agree? Because
Barry,
he was... Go on.
No, go on.
I was going to say that he was... Because at the moment of time is that he was the story because, he was going on the scoring run and then that's great and then they'll finish in the top 10 and that's brilliant, well done, after last season. But he showed that he could handle the pressure of carrying on a scoring run.
Yeah, yeah. That is absolutely bang on, and that's exactly why I've chosen it. Because this, for me, was the point where Leicester became special, where something different was happening, where you realised that, wait a minute, there's a bit of magic in the air, for want of a better word. And it was simply because that you get used to, as a sports reporter, as a fan, you kind of get used to getting let down. You get used to hype, and then you get used to things not quite living up to hype. So that game, Leicester having a good season, Jamie Vardy's on the scoring run. They're playing Manchester United in a Saturday evening kickoff. Global TV audience. He needs to score in order to break this record. The hype's incredible, and it's almost, the situation's too good to be true. So experience tells you that he's not, it's going to be a disappointment. It's just not going to happen. Reality all kind of bite, and United under Van Gaal were horrible and stuffy, and they'll probably snuff them out. And, I remember going to the game, I reported on it, and I went with all these sort of feelings, thinking, oh, he's not going to break the record, really. This was the first time the world's eyes were on Leicester, and you thought the team probably won't really handle this situation. And then he doesn't just break the record, he just scores this emphatic, outrageous counter-attacking, pure Jamie Vardy goal that's probably the best he scored in the whole run. And I've not known an atmosphere anything like it outside of odd moments at the big stadiums. I remember, I was there at Anfield when Liverpool beat Chelsea in 2000, and that was incredible. At Old Trafford when United beat Barcelona in 2008, absolutely incredible. But I think maybe it's my affinity with smaller teams. There was something different about the ground at Leicester, about the King Power, and particularly the moment the goal went in and Vardy celebrates. I mean, it was just, it really was special. And for me personally, it was one of those moments, few moments where kind of the sports reporter's hat goes off and I'm able to become a pure fan again. And it is a really good goal.
Were you surprised? I mean, watching the goal, this was all right. They weren't the most attacking, but this United side could still defend.
Yeah.
They still had the best goalkeeper, and they. I mean, Schmeichel almost casually. I was waiting for him to kick it, trying to remember the goal. He just casually lobs it out.
I know, and I think it's Christian Fuchs, isn't it? Christian Fuchs, kind of, average fullback, but he plays a beautiful pass. And I think Mahrez is involved. There's a lovely touch from Mahrez. It's kind of easy. Leicester just cut through them. But in the game, Leicester actually softened United up already. And this is what this Leicester team were very good at doing. They applied their intensity and their pressure and their pace on the break and frightened teams. They unbalanced teams. And they'd already done that to United. I think Vardy was always the leader of it as well. So early in that game, I remember watching Vardy just hounding the United defenders who were, that Van Gaal team, its biggest crime was that it was slow. And Vardy, I just remember watching him down by the touchline, just zipping from defender to defender, just terrifying them by the speed he was pressing them on the ball. And I think this goal's about 20 minutes in, correct me if I'm wrong, but the United really sort of been softened up a little bit at that point. And then, as you say, the goal, which it actually they just cut through them very easily, I think was partly a result of the pressure they'd applied on United before.
The final point then, really, in terms of about Leicester in this season, is it a little bit, is the kind of, I don't know the way to put it, but was it not fair that Leicester didn't get to win it? They didn't get to win the title. They had to rely on, ironically, Chelsea, who won the title either side of them. Do you think Leicester would have preferred to have won it on the pitch?
Nah, because, well, in theory, yeah, but think about what then happened. I mean, it actually I was in the city. It the way it occurred was just part of the beautiful story, because on the Monday night, when really it's a Monday night, and you didn't really think they were going to win the title that night. I know the players had all gone to Vardy's house and all that kind of stuff, but that was a kind of just in case thing. And they win it, Spurs from 2-0 up, draw at Chelsea, implode. And it just sparked this thing. It gave Leicester a week of celebrations, because it was an incredible night that night. The city went mad for a week. It was surreal. The players were, all over the place. And then they get to play Everton on the Saturday. Everyone knows they're champions, but none of it's worn off. It still feels surreal, and just seeing them being presented with the trophy, I think that's going to be enough for the fans. And of course, Andrea Bocelli turns up, sings. They put in this brilliant performance against Everton. People came from all around the world for that game. There was in the book I wrote a story about this group of young Italians who. Fed up. These are sort of Italian students, fed up of Serie A and the kind of problems of Italian football and the lack of magic in Italian football. Alighted on the Leicester story, which of course Ranieri was a route into for Italians, and 1,000 of them came over on buses and cars and stuff from Italy to be part of the title celebrations, and they didn't have tickets, so they just all turned up. There was a guy. Who dressed up as Jesus and just sort of came off the train at Leicester Station and said, "Take me to the King Power," and a young Italian lad, and there was pictures of him all over the internet and stuff like that. I mean, amazing scenes. So yeah, it's great to win things in front of your fans, and that's usually how it works in football. But this story was different, and I don't think any Leicester. Fan or I'm not a Leicester fan, I just live in the city now. I don't think I'd have changed it at all. I don't think anyone would have changed it. It was just absolutely incredible the whole week.
And the final thing is, because we've had far too much positivity in this podcast, it's not a done way. Will we ever see it again?
Well, logic tells you that because it's happened once and it can happen again. So I wouldn't like to say no, but we might have to. Ranieri said at the time, this happens every 50 years. And that sounds about right. And if you look at the history of English football, what happened 50 years ago, or 50 years before Leicester, more or less, Ipswich under Alf Ramsey, just promoted from Division 2, humble team, somehow won the English title. So Ranieri's right. It's probably once every 50 years. It probably will happen again. There'll be another sort of freakish aligning of planets and so on. But I'm not sure if I'll be around to see it anyway. But having mentioned Aberdeen and the fortune of then arriving in Leicester, then I've probably seen enough miracles for one lifetime and couldn't expect to see another one. Yeah, and if it is ever done again, it'll be different. So there's something unique about that Leicester story that will, like the Forest story, you know, these are unique stories that don't ever get topped.
Well, there you go. That was a really interesting chat with Johnny. Thoroughly enjoyed that with Jonathan. It was good to hear how his views of Aberdeen, and not something that in his role he gets to speak about. So we hope you've enjoyed that first one back in the series. We really do enjoy putting these together. And get on iTunes, leave a 5-star review, and tell us what you like and tell us what you don't like. We might praise the first bit, we'll probably ignore the second bit. But anyway, have a fantastic week. Bye.